Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to Mormon Matters. It's another edition of this podcast that we have so much fun doing. Today, we're going right to the Mormon Matters origins, which was to talk about things that are in the news and what's happening in the church. So I brought three great church watchers on to talk about the announcement and the release on March 1st of a new edition of the LDS Scriptures. Things are available online. Eventually, people will be able to buy those. I think it's this August that they've announced that these new editions will be available, though they're careful to say you don't need to rush out and buy the new scriptures. But there were some changes. It's been developing some great conversation online, and so I really appreciate the three who've come on to be part of this discussion again. So one of our vets and favorites, and it's been a while since we've had her on, and that's Gina Colvin. Gina, would you remind everybody a little bit about who you are?
Hi, Dan. Thanks so much. My name, as Dan said, is Gina Colvin. I am a lecturer in critical cultural studies at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand. I have a blog called Kiwi Mormon, and that's currently at patheos.com. Currently, I am the gospel doctrine teacher in my ward, which is the most fabulous ward and a wonderful, wonderful class to teach. Really, really exciting. I grew up in Christchurch, attended BYU Hawaii for a while, lived overseas in Taiwan for some time, and moved back to Christchurch, never thinking that I would live here for the rest of my life, but it looks to be that way. And we, Nathan, my husband, and I are the parents of six boys. And so that's me.
Very, very cool. Thank you for bringing all the different hats and perspectives that you have to our conversation, and especially your blog post on Official Declaration 2 and some new introductory material here I thought was just terrific, and we'll draw all that good stuff out from you.
Thanks.
Charlie Harrell, thanks for coming back on the podcast. Would you remind everybody a little bit about your background?
Sure. Good to be on again. Charlie Harrell, I teach in the engineering and technology school at BYU, and also work with a software company called ProModel, which I founded many years ago. And I have an interest, strong interest in LDS theology, particularly the development of Mormon theology. Recently wrote a book called This Is My Doctrine, which covers a lot of that development. And this is an interesting topic for me, so I'm glad to be on. I'm also married to Yvonne, and we have 5 kids, 10 grandkids, so I'm getting up there. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Thank you. And I'll always love the perspectives that you bring on and how in subtle ways doctrine evolves and changes. And so I know that as part of our discussion today, when you get the scriptures, even though the text of the scriptures haven't really been changed except for some spelling and whatnot, there is a shaping that goes on. These books are a presentation to us, and they do have an effect. And so we'll look forward to all your insights on that kind of stuff. Ben Park, welcome back. I think this is your third time, so I think all of you have been on at least 3 to 5 times.
Yeah, glad to be back. I'm Ben Park. I'm a PhD student at the University of Cambridge, where I study the cultural, religious, and intellectual history of early America. Although I've dabbled on Mormon history on the side, and I currently serve on the editorial boards for both Dialogue and Journal of Mormon History. Yeah, that's me.
And you blog where?
Oh, yeah. I participate at a few blogs and websites. I blog on Mormon history at Juvenile Instructor, on Mormon culture at By Common Consent, and I co-spearhead a biweekly column at Patheos named Peculiar People.
Okay, yeah, that's the one that I knew that I knew you were involved with that, and I'd forgotten about the others. Now, I always call it Pathos. Gina, what did you call it? Because you said your blog's part of them now.
Pathos.
Pathos. Okay, so we have Pathos for me, Pathos, and what did you call it, Ben? Pathos. Yeah, so who knows what the heck. We'll have to somewhere find along. But what are those words that, you know, in your brain you say it a certain way internally and you never know because it hardly ever gets said out loud. So funny. Well, thank you so much for being here, and you're just all great Mormon watchers, and we've kind of had some pre-conversation that we'll get some structure here, but everybody speak up at any time. So the quick and dirty version of what has happened is the church in their announcement says that for the past 8 years, they've been undergoing a project of thinking about a new edition of the scriptures, especially now that the historical department has been looking in and not necessarily complexifying, but you know, it is a complexifying process, but that wasn't necessarily the goal. But they've been sort of correcting the record here and there on different things, and so that was important to them. And then also just the growth of the new technologies that allow scriptures to be disseminated in different ways. And so what they've done is they've basically completely readied a whole new set of scriptures. They've released them online right now. In August, they say they'll be for sale. But what they've got, like I think I mentioned earlier, they've gone out of their way to say, don't rush out and buy new scriptures. Heck, if you bought new scriptures, you probably wouldn't even necessarily notice the differences here and there. They say that 99% of them are corrections in the study aids, though they have some font changes, some layout changes, some different maps, and they've corrected some spellings, they've corrected some cross-references. There's a big outline at the church's website, lds.org. Where you can kind of see a summary of everything, as well as they have a side-by-side comparison with pieces highlighted in a different color that show where it's a change. But one of the big things they were careful to do is keep whatever page a particular scripture is on in the 1981 version that we still are, has been the main one. Those same paginations exist today. So, in other words, they're not trying to make this a financial burden on anybody. So anything more about that particular bit, you guys? What else was in the announcement that caught your attention?
Well, one thing that caught my attention, I thought was kind of interesting, in the little video clip that they showed, Elder Anderson mentioned that this new edition is merely a refinement, is the words that he used, of the 79-81 editions. Kind of the implication being that we really made all of the changes, the major changes to the scriptures in the 79 and 81 editions, but there are some things that we've learned since then that we need to clean up a little bit. But as you mentioned, Dan, the text is virtually the same. There's only a spelling, punctuation changes, so it's almost more of a refinement than a major change to the scriptures themselves.
And an important example of how the text of the scriptures mostly remained unchanged is, you know, Royal Skousen, who's a professor of linguistics at BYU, who has been working for 25 years on on a project on the Book of Mormon text, has come up with dozens of these corrections to the Book of Mormon text, of these problems that have happened in the text over various printed editions where errors crop up because of whether typesetting or whoever the editor was at the time. He's come up with several dozen of these examples that are somewhat substantive changes. I mean, they don't fully change the meaning, but when you see the correction, you're like, yeah, that makes a lot better sense when you put it back to the original. And none of those were incorporated.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Even though he works for the church, they know about all the changes. He's putting together a compilation for the Joseph Smith Papers volume. It had always just been assumed that his corrections were going to be incorporated at a future edition of scripture, and they just weren't.
Which leads me to a question, probably for Benjamin and Charlie. What does anybody know the process by which these editions were made?
I wish.
Well, as Dan mentioned, it's a process that's taken 8 years. So I think there was a recommendation that they be looked at, that changes, you know, that cleanups be looked at primarily. And over that process, I do know that it was almost ready to go to print last summer. But from what I understand, Elder Jensen, Elder Snow, church historians, they said, hey, you have to look at the work that the Joseph Smith Papers Project has been doing and at least address some of the section headings in the Doctrine and Covenants and the information about that, because we know so much more. And so it was actually delayed for a while to get that in.
Interesting. I would have expected that to be right along all along. So really, the DNC headings might not have been changed.
Yeah. So I think the intent was mainly just some cleanup, you know, minor punctuation, spelling, but it ended up being quite a bit more than that.
Very cool.
Yeah, I think we could say, Dan, that while the church has been very transparent about the actual changes that have been made, they haven't been very transparent about the process itself, the actual process of the change.
I think one thing we can be safe to say is there's probably a lot of bureaucratic give and take and lots of discussion that went behind the actual changes.
Yeah. And some of the changes clearly reflect a conversation that has certainly been going on for 25, 30 years. Let's do this. Let's kind of start with the easier thing. So, Charlie, I know you've looked at some of the headings in the Bible, for instance, that have been changed. And why don't you start us with things like that? And then, Ben, I want you to go to the DNC and of its heading changes. So, Charlie, what would you wanted to say about what's going on in the Bible?
Well, that's an interesting area because from what I've been able to see on a lot of the blogs that have commented on the changes, most of them have not picked up on the explanation the church has given to explain the chapter heading changes, mainly in the Bible. But on their website, the explanation states, quote, some changes have been made so that the chapter heading more clearly reflects the text rather than interpret it.
Yeah.
And to me, I think that's a significant kind of philosophy to take with these chapter headings, so that instead of trying to Mormonize, if you will, the heading and the material in the chapters, it's an effort to say, what does this chapter, what can we say without going beyond what is in the text itself about this chapter?
Can I insert possibly a snide comment here? Instead of Mormonize, de-McConkeyize?
Or de-McConkeyize.
is that a fair thing, you guys? Because it's pretty well known, I think, that he was responsible for writing the chapter headings before, and he certainly had a very idiosyncratic theological take on it, you know, that was very powerful, that certainly showed up.
Yeah. A good example of the change that they've made, of the kind of change, they give an example in Acts 4, where the chapter heading once read, they practiced a united order, and that's been changed to, they have all things in common. So instead of reading a doctrine of united order into Acts 4, they just simply sort of use the same wording as Acts 4 and just say, they had all things in common.
I applaud something like that, for sure.
Yeah. Psalm 17 is another example they give, where the heading used to read, quote, the righteous shall see the Lord's face and awake with righteousness. That was changed to, quote, David hopes to behold the Lord's face in righteousness. So instead of universalizing the concept there to say that, oh, everybody's, all the righteous are going to see the Lord's face, they limit it or restrict it to just what is implicit in the text itself.
Awesome.
Now, I also found it interesting that the name Jesus has been removed from any Old Testament headings, specifically Zechariah 13, where the heading read, quote, they shall ask Jesus, what are these wounds in thine hands? That's been changed to, quote, they will ask the Lord, what are these wounds in thine hands? So now, of course, we can understand the Lord to be Jesus if we choose, but that isn't explicit in the text, and they were cautious to, I think, and wise to remove that so that they're not, again, imposing on the text something that isn't explicitly there.
So would you say the Lord is explicitly there in that one? I haven't explored
yeah.
that. It is. So yeah. the language in that passage befits the word the Lord, or is that still too much? Because I know that a lot of times we get these, you know, they're speaking messianically, and yet we know it's more of just the suffering servant kind of passages and not really messianic passages. In this case, they're not doing that, though you think the Lord works?
Well, now that's a good question. I'd have to go back and look at the chapter itself, but as I recall, it's actually talking about false prophets. And so the question is raised of the false prophets, what are these wounds in your hands?
Interesting.
And so that's an interesting one, and you bring up a good point that perhaps that's still reading too much into it than was explicitly there.
Yeah. Well, we'll applaud the effort. I doubt it means that church is backing off reading messianically certain things or reading Jesus into it, but at least they're just being more cautious somehow.
It's softened up. Now, as you point out, there's still a long ways to go. There's plenty of McConkieisms in the chapter headings. Ezekiel 37 is still said to be referring specifically to the Bible and the Book of Mormon being one in our hand. And, you know, while that may be a secondary meaning, the question is whether or not that was the intent of the text or whether or not that's explicit in the text itself.
Right.
So, yeah, interesting changes, a move, a step in my mind in the right direction, but still a ways to go.
Dan, can I jump in with a question here?
Please.
And it just sort of, I'm just sort of moving a little bit backwards to try and figure out the role of Scripture in the LDS Church. And the reason I say this, I'm sort of grappling with where we fit or do we not fit at all on balance with the Protestant tradition of sola Scriptura, which is, of course, the Scripture as a source of doctrine alone, and the more Orthodox Catholic tradition of both tradition and Scripture being the ultimate source of doctrine. But that tradition comes through the interpretation of the Scriptures through the apostles and through the church or the magisterium or whatever it is, or the bishops. And it just, I'm just sort of thinking about what Charlie's saying. Here are some chapter headings which have sort of two discursively different functions. And one is to, in the first iteration, it's to interpret Scripture, you know, those McConkieisms for us in a decidedly LDS way. And then there is now a movement away in letting the text just rest on its, you know, but rest on its own without those interventions. So I'm just sort of throwing out, maybe Ben and Charlie could sort of answer that question of where do we sit? Are we more Protestant or are we more Catholic, or we've just kind of come up with something of our own?
Well, I think we're a mix in between. And in fact, one of the, what I thought one of the most positive things of the new edition of Scriptures that hasn't gotten much play is found in the introduction of the Doctrine and Covenants. If you looked at the comparative section of the comparisons between the 1981 edition and the 2013 edition, there are three new paragraphs added into the introduction of the Doctrine and Covenants that I think hit exactly at that type of question of what do we think of Scripture. It says this: Joseph and the early saints viewed the revelations as they did the church, living, dynamic, and subject to refinement with additional revelations. They also recognized the unintentional errors that had likely occurred through the process of copying the revelations and preparing them for publications. So I think that's a very open-ended mantra for approaching Scriptures. I'm not quite sure what category that throws us in, but at least opens up the possibilities of revising not only the Scriptures, but how we frame those Scriptures.
I'm so glad that that is in there. That is a wonderful new change. Charlie, do you have more on? Do you have something? I didn't mean to jump in.
No, that's good. Just a couple other aspects of the Old Testament passages. Of course, we still have Nephites being explicitly mentioned in two chapter headings, as well as the Book of Mormon in a couple of them.
Okay, so again, just not fully excising.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing, and by the way, they make that comment twice. I think I mentioned that their intent with these chapter headings is to remove interpretation from them and to try to provide more just a summary information. Now, the Book of Mormon has a couple changes that I thought were interesting that go along these lines. The introduction to the Book of Mormon itself, most people are familiar with this, that it was changed from a record of God's dealings with the ancient inhabitants of the Americas to a record of God's dealings with ancient inhabitants of the Americas. So what I just read, the only difference is the deletion of the word the.
Mm-hmm. So instead of... No exclusive.
So it kind of takes that exclusivity out of there as an acknowledgement that there were other contemporaries of the Nephites and Lamanites. So that's kind of an interesting one. And then, of course, along those same lines, later on in the introduction, it says that it talks about the principal ancestors, that the Book of Mormon is a record of the principal ancestors of the Lamanites, or of the American Indians, excuse me, which has been changed to being among the ancestors of the American Indians. And of course, that was even changed in 2007 to read among the principal ancestors. So now it's just among the ancestors. So again,
an extra layer removed. And that change, wasn't that for the Simon & Schuster edition or the Random House?
It was the Doubleday edition of the
Doubleday, that's what it was. Okay.
It's very, almost all the changes in the Book of Mormon that we have, except for those few important things that Charlie pointed out, were included in the Doubleday edition and just carried forward into this new edition.
Okay.
One other interesting Book of Mormon change is the chapter heading for Alma 11. And what makes this interesting is that in the summary posted on the church's website, it doesn't really take note of the significance of the change, because it says that it was changed from Nephite coinage set forth, and there is no death after the resurrection, which was then changed to, quote, Nephite coinage is set forth, there is no death after the resurrection. So all they did was add the verb is in after coinage, and they capitalized resurrection according to the explanation given. But if you go and actually look at the chapter heading, they replaced the word coinage with monetary system, which of course is a big issue that was one of the arguments that critics made against the Book of Mormon, was that, well, they couldn't have had coinage, you know, they didn't have coins in ancient America. And, of course, conforming to this idea or philosophy of let's not state in the heading what is beyond what is in the text actually doesn't use the term coinage, right, or coins. And so the change was actually significant, but the explanation on the website didn't make note of that.
Interesting. I mean, if I remember the passage, it does talk about silver and gold, so it's kind of hard to not think of them as coins.
Whatever it is, it does open the door, you know, it allows for some wiggle room there with it.
Interesting. Fun. Well, thank you. And any more that come up for you, just work them in. Ben, we've asked you to go over the DNC heading changes, and you wrote, I can't remember if it was privately to us or on the blog, how you felt like the process of moving away from B.H. Roberts' History of the Church to just simply the more open-ended phrase of, you know, according to Joseph Smith's history. That you've seen that going on for years, and it's interesting to see it now kind of finalized. Yeah, please.
Yeah, when we had the priesthood release citing manual a few years ago on teaching to the president of the church, Joseph Smith, it even had in the appendix that we have decided not to rely on the history of the church because we basically realize that it's problematic in certain ways. And so you see where the old section headings would always reference the history of the church. Now it doesn't reference them anymore. If there's any reference, it's to the earlier manuscripts, which I think, yes, this is cool for us nerdy type, but I think it's representative of a much more important and symbolic change of being much more responsible with history and acknowledging that history is a messy project. Besides the introduction that I already quoted a little bit before, here's a few of the changes that might seem rather mundane, but I think are really important in tracing our developing historical consciousness. For example, the text for the introduction to section 2 used to read, "An extract from the words of the angel Moroni to Joseph Smith the prophet," because that's what the history of the church said it was. Whereas now it says, "An extract from Joseph Smith's history relating the words the angel Moroni." Now you see this is a much less positivistic outlook, meaning it's much less, this is for certain the angel Moroni's words. It's understanding that there's a narrative that this is being taken from, that this is what Joseph Smith's history says that Moroni said. Or
awesome.
In section 13, where it used to say, "Ordination of Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery to the Aaronic priesthood by John the Baptist." Whereas now it says, "An extract from Joseph Smith's history recounting the ordination of the prophet and Oliver Cowdery to the Aaronic priesthood." So those are just two of about a dozen changes like that. And that goes on top of lots of changes to dates, to places. Basically, the Joseph Smith Papers staff and their research are all, their fingerprints are all over these section headings, and not only correcting the facts, but framing our history in a much more responsible way.
Interesting. Now, here's a question. So we used to have history of the church, and you're sort of implying that when you did it that, and it would say that B.H. Roberts got it right, and this was really the history. And now when you say, according to Joseph Smith's history, there's nothing really called Joseph Smith's history out there, right? Is this just an open-ended phrase that, you know, would incorporate all the learning now and in the future?
No, that's actually referencing a manuscript that Joseph Smith saw that was kind of the preliminary manuscript before B.H. Roberts' History of the Church. What happened was Joseph Smith in 1838 and 1839 got some scribes together and called some historians, and they started writing Joseph Smith's history, where they took historical documents and sometimes they'd change it, they'd alter it a little bit to be spoken of as if Joseph Smith was speaking the words. And so this manuscript is, I think, what they're referencing of Joseph Smith's history says this. Now, that manuscript was later edited and expanded, and through different generations, it eventually became B.H. Roberts' history.
Okay, so what did we gain here?
I think we gained a much more sophisticated look at how history works. Rather than saying that these are the exact words that John the Baptist, or these are the exact words that Moroni said.
So what's the problem with B.H. Roberts' history? When you say it's an evolved version of Joseph Smith's history, is it just that he changed Joseph Smith, some of the things in Joseph Smith's history, into the words of Joseph Smith when they were more him conveying?
Right, that's a good way to put it. And in fact, I would say a lot of the fault for that, for that history series does not belong on B.H. Roberts personally, although he did add quite a bit, but on those scribes after Joseph Smith's death, say from 1844 through 1858-59, when they finished the project, who are, you know, we're a decade removed from Joseph Smith, Joseph Smith's death, but we still want to write this history as if Joseph Smith wrote it. So they would take documents and put it together and say, okay, Joseph Smith said this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that helps. Yeah. Well, that's very clarifying for me. So I clearly did not know. I was thinking it was this nice catch-all phrase that would allow us the latest research from, you know, Joseph Smith's, you know, history of, you know, or, you know, I just thought it was a nice little catch-all, but no, it's actually referring to something specific.
And what's great about it, with the Joseph Smith Papers project and these changes, I mean, the manuscripts and the sources that these quotes are coming from are available on the Joseph Smith Papers website. So maybe we could see at one point in the, if you're reading the digital headings for these scriptures, it will actually link you to these original sources where these revelations and verses are actually coming from.
That'll be cool.
But that is a significant thing that it seems like we're giving up. It was nice to be able to have a reference there, as Dan mentioned, like History of the Church, you know, volume 2, page 368 or something, where now it's just Joseph Smith manuscript, and what do you go to in the printed version? You wouldn't know.
I think one thing that can help with that is now that the Church History Department has those Revelations in Context series, which are basically a bunch of blog posts on various Sunday school lessons, those give lots of background for what's going on in those sections. So how they're going to orchestrate that and make it an easy reference, I don't know if or how they'll do that, but something to keep in mind.
Yeah, certainly the scholar's going to be able to track it down, but the average reader is probably going to say, okay, I'll just take your word for it that that's somewhere.
Yeah, that's a good point. Although I wonder how many actually tracked it down in History of the Church before this.
I did every once in a while, but not very often.
That's why I say the scholar, Dan.
No, just when you wanted to teach a lesson, you know, or something, you look for more. Yeah, very cool. Well, Ben, what else in the DNC headings? You mentioned like change of place. I know I read something, for instance, about instead of on the banks of the Susquehanna for DNC 13 with John the Baptist, it's now in the woods, things like that. Is there anything else that catches your eye?
Nothing that'll probably affect the general reader. I mean, historical nerds, we get excited that the church admitted that section 19 is now admitted to being received in the summer of 1829 rather than 1830. Or maybe I have that forward a year or so. But I think in those sections, just that general outlook of how history happens is probably the major symbolic change that we see in the new edition.
Sweet.
Not, and of course, then you have the introductions to the Declaration, but that's a whole other animal.
Okay, cool. Gina, anything to jump in there? Or I'm not even sure that we even finished your discussion about whether we're a mix of sola scriptura or you know, scripture and tradition. Did you have more that you wanted that discussion to contain?
No, I'm just really interested in just sort of clarifying some things. And my sense, though, is that what's happening is that the scriptures are being almost repatriated to the teachings of Joseph Smith. And so and my look at it, you know, with the change of the chapter headings, it's almost obfuscates this in-betweenness, this place that we existed between Joseph Smith and now. And it does sort of raise sort of bigger questions about the source of our doctrine. And my question would be, is Joseph Smith, therefore, the definitive source of our tradition and our doctrine? No answer.
I think we're silenced because that's an important question that's hard to get at the answer. I think verbally we'd like to think that, because we'd like to think of our doctrine as very self-referential and cohesive, and even though we give lip service to learning line upon line and precept upon precept, we'd like to think Joseph Smith left the Sacred Grove in 1820 with the fullness of the gospel, right?
Yes.
And because I think as soon as we start admitting that the full ramifications of having an open canon, then some people see that as sweeping the rug from under the current prophet's feet of, oh, they could be wrong and we'll change in the future. Mm-hmm. So, which I think is a major point behind when we get to talking about the official Declaration too. So you see a door opening in that direction of understanding a progressive vision of human fallibility and later divine correction. But I think we're taking those steps very tepidly.
The other thing is, I wonder if this sort of signals a shift to scholarship rather than scriptural interpretation as the safest bet for the church. And I also wonder if it's that's going to carry over into other intellectual work that other LDS scholars are doing.
Well, and a shift towards history. And Charlie, if I can just invite you right now, your work in the evolution of doctrine, you were doing history for sure, but you were bringing in a lot of theoretical materials that at least I for sure see. Maybe we should just talk about the introduction to the Book of Abraham first. We'll kind of jump out of the DNC, and let's just go a little bit out of order. But, you know, when you were teaching us there, you were bringing in, you know, theories of what it means to be fully human and fully God at the same time in a revelatory process. And so do you mind introducing quickly what the change was to the introduction of the Book of Abraham and then maybe kind of play off Gina's comment there?
Sure. As most people are aware, the original introduction to the Pearl of Great Price described the Book of Abraham, saying it is, quote, a translation from some Egyptian papyri that came into the hands of Joseph Smith in 1835, containing the writings of the patriarch Abraham. And, of course, the new 2013 version of the introduction describes the Book of Abraham as, quote, an inspired translation of the writings of Abraham, period. Joseph Smith began the translation in 1835 after obtaining some Egyptian papyri. So there's two interesting things going on here, it seems to me. First, there's effectively a decoupling between the writings of Abraham and the Egyptian papyri. And the second sort of thing that comes out of this is it uses the term inspired translation,
right,
which need not be understood as a literal translation. In fact, a lot of people are taking some license with that and suggesting that, that could mean anything from being assisted by the gift of God in the translation itself to an outright revelation to even an inspired writing of Joseph Smith, sort of as a scribal author or a pseudepigraphic writing of Joseph Smith. So there are a lot of different ways that could be taken and is being taken. What that does, to your point, Dan, in opening up some of these possibilities of what that might mean, it gets into kind of the theory of revelation itself.
Right. That's right.
What is revelation? Is it the passive transcription of the prophet as they transcribe the words that are given to them directly from God, word for word? Or is it something that the prophet himself or herself is involved in the process? So then the prophet becomes part of the revelatory process, a variable in the equation, if you will.
And the prophet, with all of that prophet's particularity, all of the language, the assumptions that come with status in society, that come with, you know, expectations, personality types.
Yeah, and it's more than just an interpretive process where the prophet is interpreting the impressions or the words of inspiration or the words of God into their own language. It involves, as you point out, more of a cultural contextualization of the impressions that they're getting so that it comes out in not only the language of the time, but in a lot of the thinking, the paradigms of the time itself.
Yeah. I love that change, inspired translation, and it's interesting. You opened my mind a little bit there on how it's being heard out there. I guess I'd heard all of those types of things, you know, over the last 20 years, so this does seem clearly a response to ongoing discussions.
Yeah, there's definitely a resurgence of this whole, you know, the papyri as a catalyst sort of theory,
right, where
it was just there. It wasn't really the papyri at all that was being translated, but it just served as a trigger for a revelation for Joseph Smith, or an opportunity to create scripture, however inspired it might be.
Ben or Gina, what's read a tea leaf here? Is this inspired translation going to be? How's it going to play out in Sunday school? Gina, your blog post talked about, you know, two women in a long fight in your ward for all those years, and one was, you know, she's just clearly a hardliner, and the other one isn't, and led to their fuse. What's gonna happen when you have that word inspired in there? Is there gonna be just free for alls? Is all hell gonna break loose?
Oh gosh, I mean, it's such an interesting area, really. I mean, I'm just fascinated with how this plays out culturally. You know, I'm reminded in, after the revelation in 1978, how McConkie responded to the naysayers who apparently wrote him letters to say, look, you said such and such, and how is it now that we do, you know, this new thing? How do we do this? How are we, or why are we doing this such and such? And he responded by saying, it's time for disbelieving people to repent and get in line and believe in a living modern prophet. Forget everything. And we spoke, and he goes on to say, we spoke with limited understanding and without the light and knowledge that's now come into the world. And I think that the grappling is with, and I come back to what I said before, with the in-between. What happened to that space in between? What are the mechanisms for us to make sense with, make sense of a statement like McConkie's, which is just forget everything, or the new introduction to the Official Declaration 2, which was we don't know what happened, we have no clear insights. And I think lack of clarity around those points of shift and change and contestation has the potential just to sort of splay out opinion. And so we're just, I think we're kind of, what it seems to me is it's opening up the spectrum, opening up the possibility for us to occupy Mormonism at a lot of different places along the continuum.
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of just, yeah, that's what I'm sort of thinking now. It's just very, very interesting.
Well put.
Yeah, I'm breathing easier, but on the other hand, I don't know that I'm gonna all of a sudden, because I have a word like inspired translation, now I'm gonna really pound the pulpit about it, you know, when I get a chance. You know what I mean?
Well, and before we breathe too easy, it should be noted that this was the introduction to the Pearl of Great Price. The introduction to the Book of Abraham itself remains unchanged.
Oh.
And it continues to read a translation of some ancient records that have fallen into our hands from the catacombs of Egypt, the writings of Abraham while he was in Egypt, called the Book of Abraham, written by his own hand upon papyrus.
Dude, I did not catch that. That is... Why would they change it in the one spot and not the other?
Great question.
Cadence for everybody, Dan.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it speaks to that. I mean, we're becoming so fractured as an LDS identity in this modern age that it almost serves just like the proclamation of the family, kind of a Rorschach test where you read into it what you want to read into it. And we're just kind of left at that. And I think on the one hand, it's frustrating to us because we'd rather have a clear dictation on something. But I think it should be remembered that this is probably hard for people in Salt Lake to recognize that there's ambiguity and difficulty and ambivalence on some of these things. Because, I mean, think of the process behind correlation. They want everything clear cut. They want it lined up. They want this and this and that. And to be able to give this discontinuity or this this ambivalence, I think that's rather rough and rather disjointing for them.
Yeah, so because it came my direction, I'm happy, but I forget the pain, yeah, that would be involved with
it. So at least this does give both the conservatives, you know, the very orthodox, as well as the more liberally minded theologians to kind of pick whichever, you know, version of that they want and or they prefer and make what they want out of it.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of something that E.E. Erickson said about Joseph Smith. He talked about within Joseph Smith himself, you have both the prophet and the priest. You've got the forward-looking guy, the cultural reformer, the guy that's, you know, let's move out there. And then you have the priest, let's keep it in order. Let's restore ancient things. Let's, you know, very concerned about preserving. And you look at him in both of them. And of course, then we as Mormons pick out which one we like the most. You know, we like that prophetic Joseph Smith, or we like the priest Joseph Smith that sort of nails it all down, and they're both there. They're just both within this guy's personality. It's one of the things that makes him so fascinating. Yeah. So we can all find evidence for our side kind of thing, or what we'd want. Ben, is there anything else on the Pearl of Great Price? I don't know if we fully heard from you on it.
No, I just agreed with what's been said.
Okay, cool. Well, let me turn to you again, though, next. Would you kind of overview a little bit what's happened with Official Declaration 1, which is the manifesto, the end of polygamy?
Right. Well, I think before we talk about Official Declaration 1, it's important to go back to Section 132, so the section on polygamy and the Doctrine and Covenants that was changed in a very subtle but I think important way. Previously, it had said that although the revelation was recorded in 1843, it is evident from the historical records that the doctrines and principles involved in this revelation had been known by the prophets since 1831. Now, this has been changed to say, although the revelation was recorded in 1843, evidence indicated that some of the principles involved in this revelation were known by the prophet as early as 1831. See Official Declaration 1.
Okay.
Right. So it's emphasizing that it's more of a process going on. And I think that's one of the important things that Official Declaration 1 emphasizes, that this is a progress and a continually being revised idea. For instance, in Official Declaration 1, where it talks about it ending, it says that President Woodruff received revelation, which was accepted by the church, and this led to the end of the practice of plural marriage in the church, which kind of hints toward it wasn't a clear-cut case to where we stopped in 1890. There was some post-manifesto polygamy So I think it adds some historical ambiguity, which is important. It also makes the important emphasis that monogamy is God's standard for marriage,
right,
lest he declares otherwise.
Yeah,
I think that's a point of question in some minds. I know I've been in classes at BYU, or I've known some students at BYU, some female students who are convinced that they have to rectify their minds for the idea of polygamy. I knew one girl who met with the general authority in an interview. I don't know what spurred this this interview, and she asked him about polygamy, and he said something like, "Well, polygamy is God's law. We're not allowed to process it legally now, but you have to be able to be ready to accept it in the next life." And this was pretty traumatic for her, understandably.
Right.
And here we have in the introduction it being firm in saying that monogamy is God's standard and polygamy is the exception.
Yeah, terrific. Anything else in there just that we should hear before we kind of process it?
No, I think okay. It gives good and accurate historical background for what led to the end. So, so good.
Charlie or Gina, or please, what do you guys see in that comes up for your brain as you look at that?
I would just say that along with what Ben was mentioning, that while it is positioned here as the standard, that does raise a lot of questions in people's mind about is that the standard as long as we're not able to practice plural marriage, or is that the standard in mortality, the mortal standard, but in the eternities, you know, that standard is plural marriage. Yeah, I guess it still leaves some room there for people to speculate on what that might entail.
And the only reason that you would even speculate, though, that it might not be the eternal standard is this idea that we've somehow come up with that you make spirits through sex, divine sex and gestation and all that stuff, right? Is there any other reason for us to even get all bent out of shape over that?
Is that a doctrine, Dan?
I don't think it is, but that seems to me to be, I don't want to be a mother in heaven, plural wife, or just that my job is just going to be cranking out babies, you know, instead of like, I'm fully God, like God, I'm still just the God who makes the babies. And to me, that's just a tradition within the church. And yet that's the one that seems to lead to the question, like you were saying, Charlie, of is this just the earthly standard? Because we know in the future, we got to make all these spirits.
Right.
Ben, where else would it be grounded that people would think that it's the standard in heaven, unless it were just the few people like Joseph Smith and whatnot who have been sealed to multiple women?
Well, I think it's grounded in the way we read the scriptures. We read that it was practiced in the olden times, and I think we internalize so strongly our defense of polygamy from the 19th century that we're kind of forced to rectify, okay, they can't be wrong. And so there must be something to this. And so maybe we just bought our own, we found our own defenses a little too convincing.
I agree. I just think it's wrong. So I've really got nothing to say. It's just wrong.
I'm with you too. And I don't think it's well grounded. I don't think it's anything other than, like you said, we've convinced ourselves just through thinking, and we just need to ungroove ourselves to imagine a possibility. And then a question like Charlie's of, is it just the standard here but not in the future? Hopefully it'll just go away and we won't burden especially women with it, though I have no desire to be married to many women myself.
A fun dinner conversation starter is to bring up how would we be starting to view polygamy the same way we are starting to view the racial restriction if it weren't for DNC 132.
Yeah.
But because of that, because it's within our canon of scripture, we feel stuck with it.
Yeah, stuck with it, all right.
Good point.
Interesting.
Well, this does reflect a pivot in this whole idea, because as you point out, Dan, you know, from Joseph Smith's perspective on through to the turn of the century, the 20th century, it was viewed by and large that plural marriage was the eternal law. And so you have a lot of people, you mentioned some of the brethren, leading brethren, who still kind of view it that way.
Yeah.
And it's just really starting to pick up with, I think, the rising generation that, and with this pronouncement here, it kind of solidifies that the standard is monogamy.
Let's hope that, yeah, with each succeeding generation, the parent is less emphasizing it. It's less part of the air that you breathe in your home, and all that kind of stuff.
When I was at BYU, I took a folklore class, and one of my and my research project, what I talked about the folklore of plural marriage, and I interviewed 200 to 300 BYU students, and I asked them questions of, do you descend from polygamous families? Were you taught about polygamy in the home or the history of polygamy? Is polygamy the eternal standard, or will polygamy be practiced in the celestial kingdom? And the difference of answers between those who descended from polygamy stock and those who didn't was quite jarring, and I think maybe reflective in our evolving views on it in the future.
Terrific.
And I just have a hypothetical question about that, about polygamy, and it's about, I suppose you allude to that, Ben, that polygamy as a doctrine has contemporary currency because it's a doctrine that is in a whole cohort's interest to preserve. But I have a broader question, like how would we as a church unravel from that? Like, what would happen to us as a people if we, you know, admitted that it was actually wrong? If it was wrong.
Yeah, I do not know what it would take for that to happen. It would take a lot, because as we'll talk about in a minute or so when we get to official Declaration 2, we have enough of a problem backing away from our racial ban, and that doesn't have a revelation grounding it. So I think it's an order of another magnitude to move in a direction where we will call a revelation false. That to me, I don't see in our current composition of Mormon authority and revelation, I don't see how that's going to be done.
Interesting.
Hope you're wrong. yeah, and I don't know if wrong's the right word, but again, I think that I've just loved your book, and I love the theoretical material, because if that sort of stuff can sort of sink in deeper, I think there's a way to say we don't accept that revelation without saying it's wrong. We can see what's going on in his head, and we can see his longing for, you know, what is it Bushman says, for kin. We can, you know, we can see all these factors in his head that he's trying to restore things from the Old Testament. I can somehow, at least in my own head now, look at 132 and like not feel super bound by what it says, but I'm not necessarily needing in my own heart to say the word wrong. Does that make sense?
It does to me. I can see where we could look at it as we've looked at other things. There are scriptures that we recognize may not have happened exactly that way. Was Jonah really swallowed right. by, literally swallowed by a whale? Was there a literal flood that covered the entire earth? And we kind of recognize that, well, from their perspective, and there's a little bit of myth involved, and it reflects the culture of the times, and so we're willing to look over some of those extreme kind of ideas. And this may be one of them in the future.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, that's for sure there. Well, let's move on to official Declaration 2. And Gina, your wonderful blog post processed this in a really good way, showing where you think, it's a good first step, and yet you see a preference for a particular view of prophets and things that are sticking around. So I'd love you to process all that, but do you mind quickly introducing first, for those who haven't looked at it or just for the listeners who need a quick update, what is it that Official Declaration 2 new version says?
If you really want to understand Official Declaration 2, you need to understand or revisit Official Declaration 2, the original version.
Okay, do.
Which, by the way, is very difficult to get hold of. And it's sort of symbolic of what happens to, in our church, to these really kind of scriptural or doctrinal things. They just disappear. So if you go to the LDS site, you just won't find a copy of the original. So you have to go to Wikipedia. Or your own paper scriptures. And I think the difference is that in the original version, or the 1981 version, what the introduction does is it really privileges the role of Spencer Kimball in the constitution of this revelation, and privileges the authority of the prophet, privileges an apostolic process, in which delivered finally to those of, in air quotes, Negro descent, the privileges of the priesthood. So we have that, and now we have this new revelation, this new introduction written by I don't know who, but anyway, which begins by talking about the people. Rather than talking about the prophet and the process, they talk about the people, that in LDS doctrine, all are alike unto God. And then it talks about how, as a church, we're constituted from different races and ethnicities. And then it goes back to Joseph, and it repudiates the idea that Joseph was responsible for this doctrine, saying that Joseph himself actually ordained black folk. And then it gives a disclaimer, which has me a little irritated, which says that there are no clear insights into the origins of this practice. And so I kind of wanted to talk about that for a second, because I think it points to a larger qualitative issue that we have in the church, where we muddy the waters a little bit between the doctrinal waters a little bit. We kind of flush things away rather than actually deal with the nuts and bolts of what was going on here. But I think, and I just want to share, can I just share like a metaphorical experience that I have?
Yes.
In New Zealand, we've just completed our 6-yearly census. So you guys do it 10-yearly, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 10.
A letter was sent from the area office to say that, to be read by all bishops, that members of the church should write down on their paper form the full name of the church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Now, the rationale they give is that statistics won't be able to pick up all of the numbers unless that name is written in full. Okay, that makes sense.
Okay.
Unfortunately, on the piece of paper, there are a couple of problems with that. On the piece of paper, you write these in confined boxes. In other words, one letter per box. The only thing that you could write is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, problem. The other problem is, and it comes because my husband works with census. He's in Statistics New Zealand, which is a government that is equivalent to the US Bureau of Statistics or something, or the Census Bureau, whatever it is. And he's worked directly on the census, and he looked at this because he's on the bishopric, and he was required to announce this. And he said, I cannot possibly announce it, because the reason that they're giving for the for this directive to write the full name of the church is that the church believes that any other permutation, like Mormon or just LDS, will not be coded to our religion. And he consulted with the religion consultant on that particular question. She said that's not true. In fact, we have about 20 different permutations that pick up membership of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So he explains this in a letter to everybody, to the state president and to the bishops, and says this is really problematic. He got a letter back from the state president to say, you should, unless I hear from the area presidency, please read the letter as is. You know, this is his professional work. And he was like, well, I can't all in good conscience answer that. And so he worked out with the bishop and made the announcement to say, this is what the letter says, and I just want to clarify. And then because he's like terribly, terribly honest, he went back to the state president and he said, this is what we did. This is what we said. And I explained that actually that's not quite right. The area presidency don't have it right. And then he got a very, very terse email back from the state president to say, basically, how dare you undermine what I said and what the area presidency, notwithstanding that the area presidency's instructions were misleading and patently untrue. I'm using that as an example of the muddied waters in between, the inability for some for this patriarchy that we live with to accommodate the admission of wrong. There is something in our church mm-hmm. that just has people at a standstill, particularly those who are in leadership positions. And it bothers me because, you know, in the United States, about five major churches repudiated their earlier doctrines of sort of spiritual segregation. Mm. You know, those were the Southern Baptist Convention, the Episcopal Church, the United Methodist Church, and they all came back and they didn't distance themselves. They actually said, we apologize. It was wrong for us. We did all of these, you know, we had all these policies and we had all of this doctrine. It was all conflated together with the kind of the mood of the day. It was evil. It was bad. That is not what God intends. And we're really, really sorry. But we don't have that with our church. This inability to and this paralysis around admission of institutional guilt. And that's what bothers me the most about it. Okay, I've said a lot.
Okay, so but the specific words that you're doing here, we offer no clear insights to the origin of this practice.
Yes.
You believe there are clear insights that it kind of came through the political processes, through the ideas of scripture, and that were in the air from the church leaders, that, you know, whether they were any more racist than somebody else at their time, they were racist.
Yes.
By the standards of today. So you're saying there are clear insights, and that's what really bugging about. Yeah. So this is the failure to be able to say again the word wrong or whatever language is, you wanted something stronger because clearly they're obfuscating here.
I think so. I mean, you know, you couldn't get a clearer statement than a first presidency statement. You know, we had that in 1949 that talked about this priesthood ban, or if you want to call it that, comes as a consequence of their fathers, meaning the Negro fathers, rejecting the power of the holy priesthood and the law of God. And then it goes on to talk about the conduct of spirits and the pre-mortal existence has a bearing upon the kind of body that you're going to get. That was in 1949. These are very, very, very clear statements. I suppose you could move that question and say, okay, maybe it is, why did they think that? But that's kind of creating a, you know, that's just kind of running away from the issue, I think.
Yeah, I think the wording is carefully chosen here, where it says church records offer no clear insights
into
the origins of this practice. So even those statements, like what you referred to, Jeannie, even though they give an explanatory explanation for why, that doesn't necessarily go back into the church records to say, and here is the church record, you know, the originating document that we rely on for this information.
Right.
But I agree with what you're saying. I'm just saying that it appears that the wording is carefully chosen to protect themselves.
Exactly. And that bothers me because, you know, if you are a person of color, you know, in particular, if you're you know, Afro-American or, you know, African-American or just African, it becomes really problematic because what do you to see of yourself in a statement like that? Like there is no reconciliation. There's no balm. There's it offers little but rather privileges the institution. Rather than the feelings of those who were affected by this.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, in your blog post, you made a statement that I didn't quite hear as strong just now. You said, a tenacious loyalty toward flawed human beings / church leaders rather than complete devotion to a perfectly loving, omnipotent, divine parent. In other words, you're saying that instead of just preaching like they did here, all are like unto a God, including black and white, bond and free, male and female. That's in there. This hedging here at the end, you would have much you're saying that there's just this inability or this unwillingness to say wrong or some version of that word.
Yeah, and it, you know, I was just going to say it reminds me of my husband. You know, like being a woman in the church is like being married to 1,000, you know, 100,000 husbands who all won't say I'm wrong.
Yeah, you, what is it in your blog? You said you think it's a bloke thing.
I love it. And I got some flack for that too.
Yeah, an incomprehensible preference for preserving the mythology of an inerrant leadership. And you'd put that up against why not just simply over and over again privilege a God who has no preferences.
Yeah. And somebody really amusingly put up the difference between Catholics and Mormons is that Catholics believe in the infallibility of a pope, but don't treat him as such. But Mormons don't believe the infallibility of a prophet, but do treat him as such. So
yeah, totally. Well, so that's a good larger point to make. And if we just went on, I know we'd end up just kind of all, you know, pulling our hair out some more. But I'm grateful for you to make that. There is one other thing I notice in the new thing that I think is not a self-evident statement. And right after you said it offers no clear insight in the origins of practice, the next sentence says, church leaders believed that a revelation from God was needed to alter this practice and prayerfully sought guidance.
Yeah.
That we know that is, again, there were some church leaders that says we need a revelation to end it. But that was, I think, the minority position because, again, there was no clear origin of, there was no revelation to start it. There's no revelation to end it needed. And so you had Hubie Brown and the others that are going along for all those years saying there's no revelation needed. But yet now in this official Declaration II new version, they've kind of put that in there like it was self-evident all along that a revelation was needed, and guess what? We got one. You know, does that make sense, Charlie? You have a much better history of the evolution of that. Have I said something fair, or do you want to add something to that?
No, I think that's pretty close. I think that the leading figure of the church, the prophet himself, has always kind of maintained that a revelation would be needed.
Oh, but, so no matter who the prophet was at the time, I know we're thinking David O. McKay.
Yeah, I think he would be the one closest to saying, you know, where we could say, well, maybe we could do this without a revelation, but obviously he didn't, and I think he was very close to it. But I think for the most part, all the other presidents would have agreed with this that we need to have a revelation.
Okay, so maybe I'm a little pushing a little too hard with this.
But, well, unless you're including figures beyond the president of the church. Like you say, Hubie Brown, he was a different character, right?
Right. But it seemed to me that anybody who would be debating it would sort of be on the Hubie Brown, you know, side of it versus the guys that just simply say, you know, I'm the guy in charge of this. And I know David O. McKay went to the Lord several times to try to get that revelation. And he felt like he didn't ever get a green light on it, right?
Yeah, which seems to be also a testament to the implicit faith that they have in their predecessors.
That's
to
true.
Say that if this is what they taught, if this is what has been passed down, it must be God's will.
Yeah, terrific. Well, I don't, again, thank you, Gina, for that, for speaking up. And so your if we were to give you a minute to summarize Official Declaration 2, at least in your blog post you said a good first step, but want lots more. How would you nuance that better if you had a chance to say it out loud again? What would you do?
I would say, why can't you just say sorry? If I had an audience with a first presence, that would be my first question. Why can't you just say, sorry, we got it wrong? Why do we have to live with this for another potentially 32 years? Just admit it. And it's okay. You know, it's absolutely okay for me for a church leader to say, got it wrong. Not a problem. I'm not going to sort of, you know, keel over and, you know, lose my testimony because I don't believe in their infallibility.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, you know, when you're playing around with scripture, you just need to be more thoughtful. And I wonder if they had a group of consulting them on the, you know, like a group of African Americans consulting them on the composition of this introduction. It is a nice step, but we move so slowly, so conservatively that, you know, I may not see another addition to this in my lifetime, you know, the way the rate we're going. So, yeah, good, but question mark.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost like Gina's saying she would prefer to see the church err on the side of charity than to err on the side of what, preserving an image of infallibility, so to speak.
Right.
That's exactly what I'm saying, Charlie.
Yeah. And especially anybody who studied the record is going to see that this is a truly it is a presentation of these guys as infallible when, you know, clearly you look at the record, they're not. And yet, you know, even we look at the scriptural record and we see lots of prophets from the old world and whatnot with plenty of flaws, and yet we still tend to still want to call them a prophet. So we have precedent for flawed people who still have great revelation and a calling. Somehow we just need to make peace with it better, and as an institution, I think we're behind what a lot of people come to on their own. But they seem to make it harder, don't they, sometimes than easier.
Yeah.
You know, even though I think they know that in their heart of hearts this move has to be made, they'll still kind of shoot themselves in the foot a little bit from having it made quite as quickly as it might otherwise. Mm-hmm. Just rambling there, so sorry. Thank you so much, Gina, for that.
That's okay.
I loved it. And Charlie, anything you had any more to say on the changes to OD2?
No, not on that one in particular.
Okay. Well, hey, I promised you guys a shortish podcast, so let's just head to sort of final conclusions. And just anything anybody has to say on, you know, just the general summation of this moment in time and these scriptures and what you see going forward. So I'll turn the time over quickly to Ben.
Well, I think Gina brings up those important points, but I think it brings me to what I think some of the at least pragmatic victories we have. Even though the Official Declaration 2 doesn't go as far as we would like to say, I think there are nuggets in there that we can take great comfort in. For instance, when you compare the introductions to Official Declaration 2 to Official Declaration 1, you get some important differences. Official Declaration 1, it kind of narrates the rise and a fall of a doctrine to where it's given by revelation and then it's revoked by revelation. And when Official Declaration 2 goes in and says that we don't have, that our church records don't tell why this is the case, but then it's revoked by revelation, I think it tells a different narrative. And if you look at it from the perspective that church records offer no clear insight into the origins of this practice, I think that's another way of saying that we don't have a revelation in the official start, which I think opens up a network of possibilities. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. But otherwise, I strongly agree with the other points. But in general, I think the new scriptural edition, it's an important step in how we not only how we present the scriptures, but how we view scriptures. I think it points in the direction of where we're going to go here. It's very rare when they update the scriptures. I mean, it's been 3 decades since the last edition, so heaven knows we may have to wait another 3 or 4 decades for another one, but maybe in the future, because things are becoming more easily digitized, we'll be able to see changes come quicker, but who knows? But I think overall, I think it's a great victory for us in the church with these nuggets of gold that we find in these the new additions, with lots of work still to be done.
Great. So a yay vote from you, but I haven't heard you say explicitly, as I have Gina and Charlie, it's a good first step. I really want more. Are you comfortable in your heart on where this landed, or are you really anxious and saying a lot of darn, darn, darn?
I'm happy that this gives us a lot that we can work with.
You are so diplomatic. Hey, Ben, thanks so much for being on. Really loved having you again. Thanks.
No, my pleasure. It's so great to talk to you again, Charlie. And Gina, I'm a huge fan of yours.
Oh,
and Charlie's as well. But Gina, it's great to finally digitally meet you.
Yeah, great to meet you, Ben.
Charlie, where would you go in terms of a final summation, overview, tea leaf reading?
Well, I think this is certainly an exciting event, if nothing else. It has stimulated a lot of discussion, a lot of thought, and I think it's taking us into good directions, positive directions. Personally, I feel that the changes that have been made overall have been a positive step forward. I would have wished that they could have gone a little further in some areas, but it's still a welcome change over what a lot of the explanatory material contained in the past. So I'm generally glad to see this kind of change happening in the church.
Yeah, and was any of it a change backwards at all? I mean, even though if we can all say to some degree we wish it was more, was there anything that actually looked like a step backwards? I didn't ask that in the past, I don't think.
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't think of anything specifically that was a move backwards. I think that some things might have been mixed, like we just talked about Official Declaration 2. That had some mixed things, kind of an admission that we really don't know, according to church records, why this program was practiced or this denial of the priesthood was practiced, but we are willing to concede that, but maybe that's not a concession that goes far enough for a lot of people.
Yeah, cool. Thank you so much for being on, Charlie. Love having you all the time. I love just your, everything about, as a guest, you're just great.
My pleasure.
And Gina, we'll let you bring it home. The concluding words from our sister in New Zealand.
Look, I'm happy that a change has been made. I think that's really positive. I still have lingering questions. I'd like to ask the people, what was the process? Who made this decision? And why did you do this? Because if you actually spread out all of these changes, it does hint to a more open canon, a more a symbolic change that removes some of the authority of the church and gives us the opportunity to reinterpret the scriptures. I think I've made it reasonably clear. I'm not entirely happy about the official declarations, but I do think it's something, and it'd be really interesting to see how this evolves, at the ground level.
Yeah. Well, we're just 2 weeks into it, so hopefully some things will unfold. It'll be interesting to see what, I've got to believe it's going to be mentioned quite a few times at conference, this change, and maybe they'll part the veil a little bit for us here and there.
I want to see the pretty pictures. They've promised those, haven't they, in the print version?
Yes, right.
That's right, yeah, the maps and the different changes for that, so that'll be cool. Yeah, I don't have a smartphone or anything, so I haven't looked at the app or the version that's on there. Have either of you, to see what's available, what parts of this are already there?
Yes, there's some beautiful photos, and in fact, you can go online at lds.org and look at the entire new set of scriptures. You can download them as a PDF file and enjoy them as they are.
Oh, good. So I could even access it without having iPad or a smartphone. Okay, and good. I've downloaded the PDF where it shows the side-by-side comparison, but I hadn't thought to look for the
And what Gina was talking about, access to the 81 version, it is an obscure link, but you can also access the old version of the scriptures there as well.
Ah, cool. Gina, did I cut you off there? Or did you answer the question? Did any of it go backwards? It didn't go far enough forward, but did it go backwards for you at all?
No, it's fine.
Okay, good. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, that's the way I feel. Like I kind of said, I use the words, I breathe easier here to see some of these rooms there, to sort of see that sense of historical, the historical part is influencing, like I said, when I was referencing to Charlie on the word inspired translation, clearly there's some theoretical pieces of it that are getting through. The kinds of discussions that we're having in podcasts like this and that have just sort of been in the pages of Dialogue and Sunstone for the years. Again, I'm not going to try to draw a direct line and say that, these are the key reasons, but yet it's clear that, these outside forums that we're involved with here are not evil things and bad things and studying the arc, that somehow or other these discussions, we have these discussions because of the marketplace and the fact that processing needs to be happening, and there are people who become experts in certain areas, and their scholarship gets out there and it kind of gets hashed through, and even if change doesn't happen as quickly as we want it to, it is in the air, and slowly but surely things happen. So for those who are looking at the long arc of history and who don't put deadlines on saying if it, within the next year they don't get more forward thinking on this or that, this is the kind of thing where that gives me hope, that this says, for 8 years they've been working on this, but we only learned about it now. So what are they also working on? What are the other things that are kind of moving in hopefully a direction that I really like? And I haven't really said what you said on the blog quite well enough, Gina, but just that preference for God, God's greatness, God's working with us, all those different things that you say, that's where I want to ground my religion in. Mm. Somehow or other, I think these changes in the arc is moving towards that, rather than separateness and exclusivity. I really think it is moving towards deeper, and diving in myself and feeling the confidence that I can have messages from God that, even if I hold them in my heart privately and don't always say them out loud at church, I it just helps give me that confidence that I'm still grounded in something good.
Nice. Yeah,
I don't know if that made any. Did that make any sense? Okay, it wasn't. Okay. All right. Well, I'm just rambling as always, so I'm sorry, everybody, for. Yeah. These podcasts are we're actually cranking out some podcasts lately. A lot of it's just because of the calendar. The Easter one is coming out, and the one on this because we're reacting to the news, and I had others that were already in the pipeline. So there's a lot of my crazy nasally voice out on the internet these days, but I hope everyone doesn't feel like it's homework to listen to these podcasts. So just grab the ones that are interesting to you and just keep the discussions going. Gina and Charlie and Ben, I'll ask that you guys all come to the blog every once in a while and check out things that people might ask, and hopefully we'll get a good discussion going.
Right. Thanks,
we'll
Dan.
Do that. Thank you.
Very good. Hey, listeners, thanks for all you do. Please keep supporting Mormon Matters financially. That would be a wonderful thing. And other than that, I just wish everybody a good night.
So long.
Thanks, Dan.
And cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.